Well, he took that rich man's name, and that rich man died in pain. There's a man gonna drown, taking name. Lord, 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 man gonna drown, Lord, taking name.
Welcome back. What you're listening to under me is Josh White, born on this day in 1942, and that's his piece. There's a man going around taking names. If you're still alive, we can still say happy birthday, Josh White. Maybe he's floating around listening to what we're doing here on the Mark Steiner Show. We do have right now, I want to introduce you to our next guest, Dee Watkins. He's an author and a filmmaker. He teaches at Coppin State University, runs a writing workshop on creative nonfiction at the Baltimore Freedom School. He wrote this piece for Salon that just went viral. It was sent to me by a bunch of folks, including my producers and other people, saying, you read this, you read this. It's called Too Poor for Pop Culture. Where I live in East Baltimore, everything looks like The Wire, and nobody cares what a selfie is. And Dee Watkins, welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. You can also just tweet us at Mark Steiner. So, Dee Watkins, interesting piece you wrote. I guess you didn't expect it to go as viral as it did.
I didn't.
Well, tell me why you think it did. I mean, this is interesting. What you're doing is here, you're going back home, in some senses, home you really never left. But now, as a professor, adjunct, and seeing this through kind of different lenses.
Yeah, I do see it from different lenses. And basically, it was just, I think a lot of people connect to it because it came from a place of frustration. You know, a lot of people are frustrated. A lot of people, you know, just because you have a job or just because you have an income, you know, it doesn't mean the check-to-check life isn't pretty. And I think a lot of people saw themselves in that, maybe from their own different situations, but they were just able to connect.
But you also had a way of painting this very, in a very brief story, painting this very vivid and portrait, passionate portrait about the people around you, around Miss Cheryl and Dante, and just kind of describe. You took these. You had a way of describing them in just the briefest amount of words to give us a sense of who their characters were.
Yeah. Yeah, I tried. And obviously, they're not just one thing. They're multi-layered, just like you, just like I. Like, we're all complex,
right.
You know. So I didn't want to try to misrepresent them in any way. I wanted to, you know, just to stay on topic. You know, there's a lot of people. There's something going around where a lot of people say, oh, you know, first world problems. And, you know, it's, no one cares.
Well, that was the whole thing about that. That was part of this, the subtext of the whole piece, wasn't it? I mean, you were writing about you were in this place with Miss Shirley and Buckethead, and nobody knew what a selfie was.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, except me.
Except you.
Yeah.
Because you put your feet in more than one world.
And I've taken them before.
Right. But when you have a throwaway phone that you pay for by the call,
You don't care. And what's even more disgusting is someone from Vice Magazine contacted me yesterday about doing some work, and it's something new going on where kids are taking selfies with homeless people, and it's just like it's disgusting. He sent me like a link to a Tumblr page, and there's all these kids just, you know, holding their phones taking pictures with homeless people, and it's disgusting. Like it just makes you think of where are we going at as a country, or like do people still believe in humanity? Like it's crazy. Like, I couldn't even imagine. Like my brain can't go there. I couldn't imagine evil like that.
So, what do you think that says about where we are, and what are you trying to say about where we are?
I'm trying to say that we need to wake up. And, you know, we need to be aware, and we just need to believe in humanity. We just need to be aware.
I mean, the reason I think a lot of people were taken by this is the way you describe going back to Douglas Homes or going to Douglas Homes to visit friends, old friends, getting this bottle of vodka, sitting down, playing cards. And you did layer it. I mean, you layered the stories of people in here that don't often get layered, that they're always given kind of one-dimensional views like Buckethead.
Yeah, and you know one thing about it too in general is when you hear stories like this, when you hear about people from places where I come from, we're always just one thing. So I also, you know, I wanted to say that one of the main things that people are talking about is no one's complaining. No one's complaining. No one's crying. Like, we understand life. We understand things happen. We understand why we're here. Like, we get it. Like, no one's saying, oh, please give me a handout. Just because I say, you know, everyone from where I was from thought that the world was going to shift when Barack Obama became president. And, you know, apparently, you know, it's just a pretty tough job. You know, I don't know how politics work and things like that. And I don't know, you know, how, you know, you campaign on one thing and something else happens. That's not my area of expertise. I'm just talking about what was going on where I'm from. But no one's complaining. Like, no one's sitting there saying, oh, the government owes me. Oh, you know, I want people to donate money to me. Oh, I'm having a horrible night. We had fun. I would rather be in a place like that than a lot of other places because I feel more comfortable.
Because that's home?
It's home. It's just home.
I mean, when you describe the people in this playing this card game, it's also the humanity of what you're describing people need to read. When Ms. Shirley is saying to Bucket to come in and play, get down, come play cards, but he, since he has no money to contribute, he's taking care of her.
He's cleaning up, and he would do it anyway. You right. know, there's a sense of community that that people don't talk about in general as well.
That's the layer that was missing from The Wire. Do you know what I'm saying?
No, I feel you. I feel you. I thought so too. I thought the show was brilliant.
Yeah, right.
But I also thought that you know, I don't know anything about setting up a wiretap or how police hang out and go to bars and things like that.
Right, right,
so
right.
that was a new world for me. But I do know how the street world works, and I kind of felt like some of those guys, they're one dimensional. They're straight gangsters. You know, they don't eat ice cream. they just walk around with automatic weapons and
they don't take care of the grandmothers.
Exactly.
They don't. That was the layer that was deep layer that was missing in that piece, I think.
I agree.
So that's the piece you're going to write.
I'm going to try.
So what drove you to be a writer?
So I wanted to be a lawyer at first. And then, you know, when I was approaching my last year of college, I didn't want to be a lawyer anymore. And then I wanted to, then I went to school for education. And, I fell in love with teaching. And in that process, my last year at University of Baltimore, I had two electives, and I took a poetry class and a fiction class. And so one professor there, Marion Winnick, she was like, you need to reconsider this writing thing. Her and a few other professors there was telling me, we like what you wrote. I wrote a poem that got published in their school journal called Welter. And, you know, it was like the first poem I ever wrote in my life. And it was like, well, maybe this is what you should probably consider. And I never thought about it. And then I wrote something and I gave it to my friend, who's more like a brother, who works here, MK Asante, and he was like, you need to get an MFA. You need to take this seriously.
And you got your MFA.
Yeah, well, I'm in my last semester right now.
At?
The University of Baltimore. Okay, so the University of Baltimore, Johns Hopkins University, and then back in the University of Baltimore.
Gotcha. So you went to Hopkins to get your MFA, but then you're finishing in Baltimore.
No, I went to Hopkins. I got a master's of arts and teaching.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. I'm sorry. Gotcha. So that's been a journey too, because you write about you gave up a certain life to walk a different life.
I did.
Talk about that.
It was something that I had to do. It wasn't being in the streets isn't for everybody. It's not. It wasn't. You know, I was. I would think I was good at it, but it wasn't. But it wasn't. You know, it wasn't. It was like the most. It was the darkest period of my life. It's very depressing. I'm writing about it now. Actually, I have a literary agent, and we're shopping a memoir.
So why? What can you describe what you mean by darkness? What was the darkness?
The pain. If we're talking about selling drugs and we're talking about being in the street from like just the lens that most people see it from, drug dealers are flashy. They have nice clothes, they have nice cars, they have all these amazing things. The women love them because you're like the man, and these are like the heavens that everyone, like rappers like Rick Ross, when he talks about selling drugs, he talks about the heavens, but there's an ugly hell. They don't really capture it in a lot of films. A lot of artists don't talk about it. And I think they don't talk about it because they never really lived that life. They see it through, you know, this just how we romanticize gangsters in America in general.
Right, right.
So,
right.
My point is, the heavens do exist, and you know, making tax free money in a fast way is great. But you know, when you see your best friend's mom and you have to give her drugs so she doesn't have to go out the street and be a prostitute, or you know, when you have that shoebox full of cash, but next to it is a shoebox full of obituaries because, you know, you're like 18, 19 years old and you already been to 200 funerals. And when, you know, all the hells that come with it is just it hurts and it's painful. And it was a tough decision that I had to make. But, you know, I made it and I'm glad I made that decision. I wouldn't trade anything.
What happened to you when you decided to walk away from that life and go to school? When you said, okay, I have to do something different here. I mean, what literally happened? I mean, what were the tugs that almost kept you in?
The only tug that almost kept me in was just basically like my job is what I knew how to do.
Right.
That's what kept me in. But I was just tired. I was just exhausted. I was just tired.
How old were you then?
I hated myself and I hated what I was doing. 21.
You were 21 when you decided.
Yeah.
So you'd already been to college.
I tried to go to college and it didn't work the first time.
I got you. So you went back to...
I went back to the street and, you know, I tried to go to college. It didn't work. And you know, not to discredit anything that happened to me when I was outside on the streets because, you know, it's probably why I honed my skills as a storyteller in general. Some of the best storytellers ever, you know, right there. The funniest, most interesting, creative people with unbelievable survival skills and just coping mechanisms that you can't learn in a classroom. You know, if the lights go out and all these stores shut down, I'll be able to survive.
That's an interesting way to look at it. That really is an interesting way to look at it. So if it comes and everything goes, the people have the smarts to survive outside of that anyway.
Yeah, you can't fall out of bed if you sleep on the floor.
That's one way to look at it. So, you know, I think that. So the piece you wrote here, I can understand why it went viral because it on a lot of levels, and I went viral in all worlds because I got this piece sent to me from black intellectuals I know, from white intellectual hipsters that I know, from I mean it came from all corners saying, did you see this, because I think you touched the nerve with this piece.
I think we're all connected, the black intellectuals to the hipster, to just white intellectuals, to Asian kids. I think that, and that's something that we never talk about because, you know, we all kind of want the same thing, you know? Like, we're all connected. We all want to be happy. We all want to experience success. We all want to be around people we love and care about, just the most basic things we all want.
You know, one of the things that MK said to me when he was here last, and we had this intense conversation on the air about it, and it made me think about this when you were coming on the air because of what you're doing as a writer and as a filmmaker, MK said that the biggest crime being done to young people in the inner cities, to poor people, kids in the inner cities, is not giving them the education so they understand language, so they can express what's going on, because their minds become limited because they can't express things through words any longer.
You don't have the language, exactly.
Right.
You don't.
That was a very powerful statement he made. It made me think.
Yeah, it's true. So I'm over at Coppin State University, and right now I have a freshman class full of English 101 students, and you think it's like it's no shocker that, okay, so what are you guys reading? Nothing. Who likes reading? We all hate it. It's common. You can go in every ghetto, every hood, every city. When I was a kid, I never even thought about being a writer ever. I wanted to go to the NBA, and then I wanted to be like Nino Brown. Like I never, you know.
right.
And then I think I wanted to be like a doctor at one point. Like it was all these extremes, but no one's talking about being a writer. No one's talking about getting those ideas out. And one thing that he also, where he explains it is you talk to a guy on the corner, and he'll say, you know, he'd be like, Mark, you know what I mean? Mark, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? You know what I mean? And
right.
He's right. MK's right when he said that, because the guy, he can't, yes, you know what he mean, but no, the guy, he can't express how he feels because he doesn't have the language to
There's
put
no
it out.
Verbal subtext to the stuff he's trying to say.
Exactly.
So,
and that's the problem. Because of that is why when you create these characters, they're one-dimensional and their stories are never heard because they don't have the language to explain them.
And one of the things you're unearthing then is the multidimensionalism under that limitation.
Exactly. I'm home. You know, I'm home. someone said, I read something that someone said about me. They said, well, you know, Watkins has left East Baltimore. And I'm like, I live, you know, in Ednor. How did I leave? Like, so I'm home. Like, you know, you don't understand the mentality. You don't understand. You know, people don't, okay, so people don't understand how, you know, they don't understand the street. They don't understand. They don't really understand that, you know, you can have a nice shirt, but you still can be flat broke. You know, actually, the best, my best dressed friends are my brokest friends, honestly. You know what I mean? But they don't really understand that. You know, I'm home. And I would love to stay. You know, hopefully it works out. If one of the institutions here, you know, Morgan's looking really good.
One of these places.
But I'm home, you know, and that's my responsibility. My responsibility is to tell the stories of people who can't tell them for themselves. And on a side note, to also inspire them to read, because a lot of people who don't like reading read this piece, who I gave it to myself, and, you know, they was like, yeah, I like that. You know, I'm into it. I thought it was good.
So when did you read your first book, your whole book? When did you first read when did you start reading?
Man, Child, and the Promised Land was the first book I ever read. And I probably didn't touch a book for maybe like 5 or 10 years after that. But once I kind of got it, I got it. Like, once I got it, I got it. So now...
Man Child's an old school book.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it inspired me. That was the first book I read. And the second book was... So as a child, I only read 3 books. Maybe until my 20s is when I started reading. As a kid, I never read any books in school. I think they gave us like Ben Carson's Gifted Hand, and I'm glad I didn't read that because, you know, I may have been like the second black guy in the Tea Party right now. But I read Man Child in the Promised Land, A Narrative, The Frederick Douglass, and Alex Haley's Malcolm X were the only 3 books I read as a child. Mm-hmm. I didn't pick up reading until later, but. You know,
so I'm curious what Dante, Miss Shirley, and Buckethead say about this. Do you have conversations with them about this whole world that you're talking about?
They didn't read it. They all have it. They all had it way before it came out. I told them about it. They didn't care I was writing about it. None of them read it. I'm not super mad, but
why do you think that is?
I guess they just don't have a general interest. I mean, you know, they're not. So all the attention that I've got from the piece, all the emails, all the people in touch, blah, 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 blah.
From the outside.
Yeah, from the outside. We had, but it's, you know, that's still, I'm still me. And, you know, I'm still me, and it doesn't really matter. And I've made $0 off of it as of yet. And it's not even about the money. It's about the message. You know,
this is a blog you wrote for. Yeah, you wrote for a salon, right?
Yeah, so
they don't pay for that.
Yeah, well, they do. They give you like $100 or something
okay,
like
right,
that.
Right.
But I see you out. I'll be around on me, but or on salon, I guess. But I think this world, for this essay to go viral, you know, that's pop culture, right?
Right.
Some of us aren't plugged into pop culture.
So what does that mean? Let's go there for a minute. What that means about not being plugged into pop culture. How does that affect, you think, the larger society we live in when so many young people are not plugged in? And what does it mean for them not to be plugged in?
It's good and bad. The good is, you know, if you aren't plugged in, then you don't have to see disgusting things like taking selfies with homeless people. The bad thing is that the way we receive information now and how these news cycles works and what's going on in the world. Like, it's so easy to get information now, but there's so many people without internet access. The average kid in East Baltimore right now is probably only accessing the internet through some type of cell phone via, you know, stolen minute plan, whatever, however they got it, family group package or whatever. This is how they get online, you know, and it's, you know, they don't have computers and tablets and things like that. So, it's bad when you aren't able to get the information that you need to just be productive and grow as a person and be able to, you know, tell these stories or share these experiences that me and you are sitting here talking about. It's good when you can just avoid, you know, George Zimmerman DMX fight. I don't want to see that. I don't want to read about it. I don't want to think about that, you know?
Right.
So I guess it's, you know.
I mean, it's, you know, one of the things I was thinking about, that we have, there's a group I've been involved with, come on the show, called The Intersection. they're mostly kids who have gone through a lot of what you've gone through and other people have gone through in deep in the inner city, but they've gotten to this program, so now they're off to college, and I kept looking at them and thinking about, there are thousands of them out there who aren't there, and that's what we're losing as a society. We're losing their contribution to the larger world.
We have to work toward, changing the negativity and identifying the things that connect us all and just building from there, you know? Like I said, we're so different, but we're so alike. And I think sometimes we forget that, you know, with political parties and race and class and things like that. And we need to just get back to the bare basics. Like, you know, a fun Friday night for me is a fun Friday night. A fun Friday night for you is a fun Friday night. It's still Friday. We both have fun. Let's start there. And I think once more people do that, I think the world will be a better place.
I was thinking about this the other night. I was reading, I'm interviewing this author coming up this week. She wrote a book called Forbidden Fruit. And she'll be on our show this week for Valentine's Day. It's about the romances and love during the Underground Railroad. Fascinating book.
Wow.
Really fascinating book. One of the things that struck me was this: the culture of people coming out of slavery was that I need to know how to read. I need a book. The power of the word was kind of inculcated because it was denied. But now the power of the word is like it's hidden or not given, and so given less importance. That's a bridge somehow that has to be made, both in terms of how policy, how we do schools, but also just about just internally in the community to go, this is important, you know?
Yeah, it's crazy because you go to certain areas, you know, again, like there's so many kids that were so quick to tell you, I hate reading. Why? Why? It's almost like these kids in these areas are biologically programmed to not.
But
like
you were
reading.
That kid. You were the kid who hated reading.
I was
right?
I mean, I didn't hate it. I just didn't do it. Like, I didn't hate. Like, I can sit down and finish a book, but I just didn't do it, and I didn't understand how important it was. You know, I didn't understand. Like, I got it later on, and you know, my thoughts went from being extremely simple to, you know, I can go off the deep end sometimes, and that's just, you know, from the power of being able to just dream and imagine and figure things out and just, you know, the power of reading is the most, it's reading is as important as water.
Yes.
In my opinion.
No, because the reading, because you don't get a sense of the world, of what, of the complexity of existence, of different ways of thinking without looking at books that cover every culture. I mean, one of the things is the problem is you know, you even when I was thinking about this at night going to theater, if you go to theater that's, let's say, a mostly black production mm-hmm. or by a black playwright, mostly black actors, that's, you see black folks come out and there are not as many white folks. If you see a production that is written by a white playwright, that's the quote-unquote standard theater, not really, but then on the audience is almost entirely white. We don't have each other's worlds. And if we don't have each other's worlds, it seems we are less because there's so much we're missing.
There's so much we're missing. There's so much.
I mean, when you tell Dr. M.K. Asante about the books he reads, you know, his books were like, when we talked about it, were like all over the map. They spanned the ethnic spectrum and from books from the 12th century to books to the 21st century. So, I mean, that's just to understand who we are as people.
Exactly. No, you're right, especially in a city like Baltimore. Baltimore is extremely segregated. Even like when I go to different places or when I even do things with different friends, it's almost like I'm in two different places, you know?
Class and race,
two different places.
Maybe your friends will read this, I mean, what you said. I mean, I think that you know, I think about this because these stories are so universal. I mean,
When I come back with the rig cams and a trailer to do a film, then, you know, and money for them, then they're gonna, then they'll get it. When I'm able to really shed light on all of these situations, then they'll get it.
Because how many bucket heads exist in the world? People who didn't commit a crime, and everybody knows they didn't commit the crime, but they did the time anyway.
Too many. And it's just, you know, it's the product of an unjust system and street culture. You know, I mean, you think about it. You know, he tells on the person that does the crime. You know, he gets another chance at life and he gets to try to do some things. And, You know, but he can't come back home because, you know, you die, you know. You tell people, they'll take you out. And on the other side of the spectrum, okay, so you don't talk and then, you know, you go to prison. So, you know, you come home and, you know, oh, yeah, he's the man. You know, he took that time. He didn't tell. He's a stand-up guy. So you get that love home, but the rest of the world is like, okay, you can't play anymore.
You're not my ex-felon. We don't get you a job.
Yeah, you can't right. get a job anymore. So, you know, it's, you know, I want to talk about all of these things.
Well, good. Until you get the full-time gig at here or some other university, and until your book comes out, and even after that, you have a platform here. We'd love to have you come back.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
This is great having you. Dee Watkins has been with us. Dee Watkins teaches at Coppin State University. He is an author and a filmmaker. Runs writing workshops and creative nonfiction at Baltimore Freedom School and other places. We'll link to this piece he wrote, Too Poor for Pop Culture, on our website, steinershow.org, so you can read it yourself. There's ways to contact him at the end of the article so you can stay in touch, and it's just a very important piece. You'll see why it went viral. And Dee Watkins, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, it's time for a weekly look at food, the future of farming, and our environment. Soundbites is coming. Stay with us.
They call the rising sun.